Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest, as I was stating to him prior to the start of this recording, leaders like me, leaders that are out there now, we always stand on the shoulders of giants. And the shoulders that I have today on VFE definitely have, he has a very big shoulders, right? I call him, he's a part of the Mount Rushmore of superintendents. And it's just absolutely my honor to have Dr. Ron Cabrera. Ron Cabrera, yes. We got him on VFE. We want to talk about legendary legacy superintendents. Just a legend in the field. Dr. Cabrera has paved the pathway for many of us coming through. I remember reading about Dr. Cabrera when I was, Dr. Cabrera, I'm not saying you're old, but I remember when I was an assistant superintendent or principal transitioning into the assistant superintendent role. I was looking at what you were doing, Dr. Cabrera. And just extraordinary, just following your work. So it's just an honor to have you on VFE to have this conversation. I'm in awe, but good to have you, Dr. Cabrera.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Connor. What a pleasure. What an honor as well. And you're really kind with those compliments. As you know, education and leadership is all about, it's a people business. And we can't do it without others. And obviously, I hope we can bring people together with a common mission, common passion. And the work that I've done in the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy has been kind of a collection of that, I guess, effort and common vision. And I'm glad you and I want to have that conversation about that today.
Absolutely. And Dr. Cabrera, we're going to talk about your legendary career in education, your impact that you've had as a superintendent, preparing superintendents and leaders now. The Colorado ALAS, of course, we're going to bring that up. And then we are going to unpack the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy. But for my audience, right, that do not know Dr. Ron Cabrera, you had a decorated career, as I stated, as, you know, one of the legacy superintendents. You mentor current and present, current and past, still present executive leaders, and now, of course, leading the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy. But for my members that do not know who you are, or for my viewers, I should say, that do not know who you are, if leaders, teachers, or stakeholders of this ecosystem were to engage with you, what song would they choose to describe, Dr. Cabrera, your leadership signature?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, I'm going to come across a little like an older guy that I am. So I had any number of different songs that flipped in my head. But the one I've been listening to most regularly, that whenever I get pumped up at the work I'm doing, is actually Glory by John Legend and Common. And, you know, it's taken from the movie Selma. And the first time I heard it, it sounds so heroic. And then I listened closely to the lyrics about, you know, essentially it's about persistence. It's about having a mission and overcoming challenges that still exist. And it spoke to me. So when I go for a walk, I usually listen to it a couple different times. When I go into my leadership sessions, I usually kind of preview myself with you. It's a little bit of my pump up music, if you will, because it really talks about what we as leaders of color need to understand, and having the strength and the vision and the will to keep moving forward. And I think that song speaks to me in that sort of fashion.
And Dr. Cabrera, I'm just writing down your statements. Love the song Glory, right? John Legend and Common, just amazing song. But as you further unpacked it, what we need to see is that level of glory, right? And we look at these strands, right, of the song that you identified: persistence, right, addressing challenges, leaders of color having that strength, vision, and more importantly, Vera, what you're preparing leaders of color to have the will to continue on in the education ecosystem, because it is a very challenging, arduous task, specifically as a leader of color, to be persistent and to address the persistent issues or quandaries that we're seeing in education. So Dr. Cabrera, Glory, love it. Love the choice. Amen with that. But I want to speak on your work, the work that you're doing with the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy, because kind of going back the prerequisite, right, with your work with the Colorado Allies has impacted many leaders. But when I think of this innovative structure for leadership development, you combined three other state affiliates to join Colorado Allies to form the Four Corner Latinx Leadership Academy. Very innovative, Dr. Cabrera. You're hearing or you're getting leaders from four different states where they're coming together as this community of practice focused on leadership development. Moreover, preparing leaders to go into the superintendent role. Wow. Dr. Cabrera, thank you for developing this program. These programs are needed, but the intentionality, right, and the interdependency of the different allies is just a remarkable innovative structure that you created. But can you unpack the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy? Can you unpack the program frames, structures, and more importantly, what are the goals and long-term vision of the program as you're launching this year or already have launched Cohort 5?
Sure. Thank you. Well, I think to answer that question, it's fairly involved. So it probably needs to have a little bit of an origin story, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, my observation for people like yourself, Dr. Connor, like myself, and those leaders of color that have persevered and gotten to leadership of that have some influence in systems, we are all outliers. We are not typical in the system. So if you take a look at any United States public school system with a growing number of students of color, there's a great disproportionality between not only who's in the classroom, but who's leading that system. And so I was at the time the president of Colorado Association of Latino Administrators and Superintendents, or Colorado ALAS, as we call it. And I was at a gathering that the ALAS, the national organization, the mothership, as I call it, pulled the different affiliates together. And I was talking to my colleagues, and ALAS had kicked off their superintendent leadership academy. Take people like yourself when you were an assistant superintendent, or when I was an assistant or a deputy superintendent, see, what does it take to step into the next role? What does it take to make you competitive, marketable, so you can convince others that you have that skill set? And, you know, it's a wonderful program, and they do a magnificent job. I heard a lot of really good things. And I was talking to my colleagues. I said, here's the problem at hand. We mostly have, when we made inroads into leadership, they're at that middle manager level. They're principals. They're assistant principals. And obviously, to be considered to be a superintendent candidate, they need to get into senior leadership. Executive directors, assistant superintendent. And so it was a very tight pipeline getting to that opportunity. And it's mostly for two reasons. And this gets to the structure piece. You know, my argument with my colleagues, particularly in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, is that we were all suffering from the same thing. We're all trying to do it by ourselves. We're trying to encourage and, you know, maybe through some connections, get a small trickle going. Collectively, we can begin to bring a cohort together, and that's what brought the four corners together. I said, all right, by ourselves, it's not going to make much of a difference in the southwest portion of the United States. And there's great disproportionality in terms of representation of leadership. And so we wanted to create a system that helps school leaders of color. And obviously, to get into it, you have to be recommended to participate. So we have people who are presuming positively have the skill set, maybe it's fairly raw, they have the qualities and the passion, and they're part of the cohort. And we want to move them from having this narrow focus of saying, I just need to be a good principal, to saying, all right, let's move it to a bigger picture. Where can you take that next step I want to provoke you to the next level. But if I do that, you need to have a different skill set. There's a truism that says the skills and qualities that got you into the job are not the skills and qualities that you'll use for the next job. And I think you and I can speak to that as well. And so we take the four corners now, so it's each of the different regions where we attend. We take this traveling group of leaders that come together as a cohort. We move from state to state, and each state hosts a leadership session based on systems leadership. Systems leaders going from thinking small tactics to systems solutions. And, you know, we do deal with the notion of equity because, you know, equity in an approach and equitable practices helps all kids, but it in particular helps those kids who are marginalized, most of whom, if you take a look at the data, are students of color. I can speak really readily to Colorado data, and there's disproportionality of how our Latino kids, how our Black kids, our Native American kids are doing in contrast to our most successful kids. And it's not for a lack of smarts, because I've seen some of these kids out in the street. They're smart kids. It's the lack of equitable instructional practice to get them on the same track, to accelerate them and the like. So as equity leaders, and I'll go from being said maybe an equity advocate in lowercase to an equity leader in large case, is to create that image of passion that we try to do in the four corners of Latinx Leadership Academy. The outcome, the long-term outcome, is twofold. One is to say, we now have a set of leaders that have an understanding of systems leadership. So when they get to that next role or when they apply for the next role, they can speak to those types of things. The worldview has now gone from being small, I just know my building, to larger. I know how to operate and work with people, work with partnerships and so forth. The second outcome really is to grow that next generation of leaders, of school leaders that can reshape our school systems. You know, we'll start first, you know, in the Southwest portion of the United States. And hopefully that becomes a, you know, a bit of a coalescence and create a critical mass that moves itself. And so when you, Dr. Connor, are able to take this, and I'm hoping someone says, hey, that's not a bad idea. Maybe we want to start it here. And, you know, as the idea of collaboration then helps generate a larger critical mass, create the type of change. And let me be clear. We need to go beyond continuous improvement in systems, because if we continually improve a system that has, I'll use this term, it sounds harsh, that tends to be oppressive to people who aren't part of that system, then, you know, it doesn't help us. We leak in a few people like yourself or myself into the system, but it doesn't create the necessary change. So we need to change the school system to meet, I think, the vision of the origins of public education. I believe in public education, Dr. Connor. I am. My parents were immigrants from Mexico, and clearly the message they carry to us is that you can need to get a good education, right? You get a great education, it does a couple of different things. You know, it moves you up for job opportunities. You have the skills and qualities to be a better job. Secondly, in the eyes of society, you've elevated yourself to have a greater sense of respect and interaction with them. And I think we can do that for all our kids in this circumstance. And that's the point of it, in my eyes.
Dr. Cabrera, well stated. Wow. You make me want to join the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy right now. I can't wait to my audience and my viewers. I will be going out to see Dr. Cabrera, and we'll be meeting the participants or the cohort five of Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy. But to my viewers, right, even though Dr. Cabrera was unpacking the program, logistics and pragmatics, please take into consideration some of these major themes from his answer. One, right, representation of leadership, Dr. Cabrera, right? That it takes a different skill set, and then we have to continue to expand that skill set because, you know, you and I know, being leaders of color, Black and brown leaders, We have to navigate the system differently than our counterparts. And for your program to be able to recognize that and expand that to three other states, including Colorado, just innovative with that. But I want to touch upon systems leadership and system solution, right? And for me, I remember when I made that transition, I didn't have a Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy. When I made that transition from principal to assistant superintendent of teaching and learning, one of the biggest transitions that I had to, or dissonance from the context of transition that I had to go through, was looking at it from my building to now adopting this systems lens that incorporates thinking of alignment and coherence with different elements and tenets of the system. Huge system shifting thinking from the context of grounding that systems level approach with various solutions to add to that. But I want to expand, Dr. Cabrera, before I get into the next question, is that when we have this systems approach or this systems lens, and you hit upon a great point, right? We can't continue to do continuous improvement the same way because we're improving on a model that has essentially disenfranchised its students, right? If you can expand on that, right? Because when you think of systems leadership and now reimagining what the continuous improvement processes look like, how can we balance that equilibrium of this systems lens, using a diagnostic lens to actually identify the gap areas, and then have this reimagined continuous improvement lens so that we can disrupt the traditional origins of the operating model in education, i.e., the industrial model?
Right. Well, I think you hit it on the very end part of your commentary. So we are working from a frame of an industrial model where things are packaged and there's a great similarity almost across the board and consistency. And that certainly does connect with any number of populations and stakeholders. But it also dissipates a lot of fragmentation and others, usually those folks who haven't come into that system prepared. I mean, it's, everything you read about the research around public education in the United States was built around the notion of a middle class population, having that type of prior knowledge, kind of the social think of that in order to be successful. And, in parts, I'd say that's not all bad. And actually, I do believe public education is to help build the sociological, moral foundations of a country. Or else there might be anarchy, right? But be that as it may, if we say we're all going to be participants in that, a systems thinker would say, all right, we know now that our participants are different. They come from a different mindset, different experience, lived experience base. And so the outcome is what we still want. We want to have productive citizens. We want them to understand what the social good is for everyone, and it involves success for themselves and for the rest of the world, right? The rest of their colleagues, family, community, so forth. So one of the things I really thought to myself is that as a systems thinker, it's a little counterintuitive. Most systems need greater focus, okay? Because it's really, an approach is really kind of a scattershot. Now, isn't, so this to say, the system isn't not trying to do the right thing. They populate, they sprinkle little programs here and there, tutorials, a new reading program there. They bring in partners in, and so they get little shots and you get little pockets of some successes. But it's not a systems-wide success because it's too fragmented and there's a lack of focus. So a systems thinker would say we need to actually counterintuitively not take a wide look at the problem. We need to narrow it and identify those areas of greatest leverage points. Now, particularly for students of color, that means then, so if we know that our current programs doesn't capture that, our focus point is going to say, all right, what do we need to do, say, with instructional practice and curriculum to connect with our students? What do we
Yeah.
need to build to do to build the capacity of our teachers, who unfortunately,
Absolutely.
have been trained in A, how they learned.
Yeah,
They've been trained
absolutely.
in that. They're just reproducing that model. And so we need to train them in a model that helps them connect with this new population and,
Absolutely.
and understand what success might look like then. Now, we could even do this using some of the skill assessment markers that we use now, and we could argue whether, they're culturally adaptive or that type of thing. I'm not going to get, I mean, you can't change so many things at the same
That's
time, right?
another episode. That's another
That's
episode.
another episode. We'll get to that. I mean, there's so many things, but,
Exactly.
I think that the other thing is, with respect to that, what our system in this process, we have to build the notion of relationships.
Yes.
What happens in that classroom is a powerful relationship between students and teachers.
Yeah.
And I can get, I'll go into some depth in that in a bit. But, and as a systems leader, relatively speaking, what's our relationship to the other people in the system? Now, I'm not saying particularly if you're a superintendent, and I was a superintendent of the Denver Public Schools, there's like 10,000 employees. I'm not going to know everyone's name.
Right.
But I'm going to make an effort to know as many people in my immediate circle and who their immediate love next layer, because that sense of personalization communicates that we need to carry that through the system culturally to understand people's names, understand their strengths, understand their needs, and then come up with ideas and approaches around it. So here's an interesting thing. So I did spend a little bit of time as the interim superintendent of the Denver Public Schools. I alluded to that. So I'm doing some work with the Denver Public Schools now as we speak. Our colleague, Dr. Alex Marrero, is trying to make some changes, and so he's asked me to do a little bit of work.
Shout out to Dr. Ferrero. We love him. How you doing, Doc? Miss you.
He's a good
and
man.
Dr. We had Dr. Marrero on the very first episode of VFE, and
oh, no
then
kidding.
And then the 1 year anniversary on VFE, it was Dr. Xander DeGalvan and Dr. Alex Marrero on two episodes of VFE, the first episode and then the first episode of the second season. So yes, Dr. Marrero, we love him.
So so I'm doing some work with him, and so I happen to be in the elevator, and somebody comes on. We're in the administration building, and I was done for the day. I was going down, and she goes, you look really familiar to me. And I go, well, I was the interim superintendent. He goes, oh, that's right. He goes, you were the interim superintendent. He goes, you're the only person who's ever come by to say hello to our department. And that seems like such a minor thing. But she said, that really was something. Now, let's take that little testimonial and say, what's the impact when my teacher knows my name at a deeper level than just say, hey, Cabrera, but says, hey, Ron, how are you doing today? Did you understand yesterday's lesson? Back that up. What does it matter when the school leader says and connects with all his teachers, all her teachers, and says, I'm checking in because I want to make sure two things, that you're doing well and you feel confident and competent in your instructional process with your kids, because this is part of our approach. So this whole notion, and I'm not the one who coined this, of knowing name, strength, and need, is a powerful kind of approach in a system. A system leader has to kind of somehow transfer that throughout the system. Now, you mentioned a system leader also has to understand there's other variables that come into play.
Yeah.
Because when you make a move at the center of the system, it reverberates greatly throughout a system.
Yes, yes.
And you have to understand that part. So you have to be tactical or really strategic, let me say that, in those moves. And that's part of that coherence. When I am coherent in what I'm trying to do and not grab bagging things, then every move I make in a system is intended, because I know it's going to have an effect throughout the whole system. And that's where you need to have the relationship to bring partnerships for other people to carry that message of purpose and carry the message of kind of the fidelity of the implementation and so forth. So it leads me to the last part of what I think a system leader has to be really cognizant aware of. Dr. Connor, you can say to me, Ron, this is what we need to do, and this is why we need to do it. And I go forth and want to do, you know, what you propose, that strategy. And then I come to the realization, I don't know how to do that. You know, I'm either going to guess, or, you know, I'm not going to do it, or I'm going to need to raise my hand and say, hey, Dr. Connor, how am I going to do it? I don't know that I have the skills. So it's this idea of capacity building. We need to build the capacity of the of our layers of leadership in the system so they can carry out our strategic objectives throughout the system, and that they can speak to it in a metacognitive sort of way. Now, one of the things you alluded to is I do executive coaching right now, and I work with any number of leaders, and I'm working with a gentleman who is almost apologetic that he's now in the role that he's at as a school leader. Now, and he acknowledges his own sense of, you know, I'm a white guy, I know I have privilege, and I've all, to use his words, I've almost like fallen backwards on my ass into success. And so I'm essentially, all right, so what is it you do? You know, how do you account for that? And, you know, it's like, and he started explaining, and I said, it sounds very intuitive what you do. Yeah, you know, I just kind of do it.
Yeah.
Well, we have to, we don't have that comfort level, Dr. Connor.
You're right.
We have to be very metacognitive and thoughtful about how we approach our leadership.
Absolutely.
Because we, you know, our ability to have a little grace on either side, not much. Not much.
Wow. And to my audience and my viewers, this and Dr. Cabrera, we use our the VFE viewers and audience, we use this as an asynchronous mechanism for professional learning, specifically for leadership, right? And when I think of this, or the answer that you provided to my viewers, please go back, because basically Dr. Cabrera just unpacked, unwrapped, and probably a 3-minute answer, systems leadership 101 for you. And he highlighted the word that I think is so it's so critical, it's essential, it's imperative, it's an educational imperative within systems level design, which is coherence. And you stated that multiple variables play into this origin of systems redesign or systems reimagination in the context of this disruptive, I like to say, continuous improvement process. I think, Dr. Cabrera, you hit upon a very important point, a strategic point, and the alignment or the parallelization of systems thinking, systems leadership, but building the capacity and alignment to that systems leadership or system solutions that you're identifying to be able to enhance, I like to say enhance, to accelerate the continuous improvement process that is not fragmented, but also that has this lens of what you said earlier, the capital E, the equity driven, right? And it has to be, continuous improvement has to be equity driven, because you talked about the disproportionalities, proportionalities of our students. When we think about that, the exact metric, 57% of our students within the next 2 years are going to be Black and Brown. So we have to have this equity-driven systems-level approach that is obsolete of being fragmented in design, because that's where we're going to get the immense variability within our systems. Dr. Cabrera, thank you for that. I took a lot of notes, tactical and being strategic, but I want to get to this next question, because I could spend the whole episode on systems design and systems systems theory and systems reimagination, specifically in the context of capacity, in the context of enhancing continuous improvement, but also this equity-driven approach that takes in our, I like to say, most important customers, our end users in mind, Generation Z and Generation Alpha. You touch upon how teachers are trained the way that they were taught, and we cannot apply those same pedagogical practices with Generation Z, Generation Alpha. But I want to get into a conversation that you and I had. This was about a couple weeks ago, Dr. Cabrera, where we had this candid discussion regarding race, culture, and what excellent, what that looks like, that triangulation looks like in the context of closing access and opportunity gaps among Black and Brown students. Now, Dr. Cabrera, you highlighted it before previously in the answers that you provided, but as you continue to highlight and elevate this problem of practice in a broad contextual realm, where are the opportunities for accelerated growth, and how should leaders pursue these endeavors with this critical word, being strategic, but underscoring this level of strategic intent in the context of addressing our Black and Brown students in public education?
Well, you know, this is, if we could pull this off, these are the silver bullets that you can't quite pull off just yet, but I am hopeful. And I think they're bound in two different containers. One is what I call explicit expectation. And I'll speak to that in just a minute. And the other one is what I call culturally adaptive instructional practice. Okay. So I'm working off this assumption that when we have teachers and even most of our leaders, we have assumptions of what classrooms ought to look like and how students ought to participate and how they ought to, you know, take in the instruction and in some sort of, you know, magical voila moment they'll have gained the learning. I think there's enough research to suggest that that hasn't happened really. Mm-hmm. And our most successful teachers are very explicit in the expectation of what they want from their students. And to follow the path that Stephen M. R. Covey said about speed of trust, so there's relationships in there.
Yeah.
He says that, you know, to build trust, you have to have clarity of expectation. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a teacher in the classroom, I want to be explicit about what I want from you, Dr. Connor, as a student.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? These are the type of performance levels I expect from you.
Mm-hmm.
So no one's guessing. Similarly, because it's a two-way street, I, as a teacher, would say, and here is what you can expect from me. Okay. And so it's not a carte blanche type of thing. There's two ways of expectation. Now, my expectation would be is I will get to know you and I will shape instruction to meet your best, to the degree possible, your best needs in a manner that you can best learn it.
Yeah.
That gets to the instructional component. We have to, I believe, take some time, and there's enough research now floating out there that says there are different approaches mm-hmm. to help kids connect to the learning. Mm-hmm. Now, let's presume positively that most of the standards we have are good standards. We've had a lot of teachers, you know, who've studied the standards, and the outcomes they have make good academic sense.
Mm-hmm.
What they lack oftentimes, though, is the cultural connections that says this has meaning to me and my lived experience. So there are some curriculum things that have to happen.
Yeah.
There are some practices that we now call it, you know, engaging students. But, you know, that's a little too broad right now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We have to have a better sense of what that engagement needs to take look like. So they can kind of express their learning in a manner that makes good sense.
Yeah.
You know, and they see themselves in the storyline of the lesson.
Yeah.
So if my father, Isidro, you know, sees himself as part of, you know, somewhere in the history of the United States in mostly, I say, a positive light, then A, I'm going to probably pay attention to it. B, I'm going to feel better about myself. And C, I'm willing to contribute. You know, and using history and social studies, you know, is one of those places where there's so many places that are lacking with respect to that. So that's a curriculum adaption. The instructional adaption would be to say, all right, Ron, we're doing this study in the development of the migration of the Southwest.
Yeah.
Well, we know already that it was colonized first by folks from Spain/Mexico, and then the United States and their Western movement, you know, overtook it. Let's find out something about that. Mm-hmm. Now, my interest is piqued because for me, my parents were Mexican, right, and became U.S. citizens. Now, obviously, I'm an American United States citizen, but I have an interest. I still have a cultural connection. And so this, the smart teacher says, this, take what your experience, let's take Dr. Connor and Michael's experience and bring these together. And now what's the learning? It's a larger picture of what the United States was and is. And I have a greater appreciation of it. Well, it's a richer context. It's not just a slice of it. So that's a culturally adaptive instructional approach, I would say. Now, I'm sure you have folks who are stronger in that than me. Fine. I want them to refine it. And we have some folks who do some of these things that, you know, who are out in the field right now who are beginning to practice it, but none of it's done at scale. And that's the problem here.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
And Dr. Pereira, just for my audience, just more in the lines of level setting and clarity, because this could be a new way of looking at culture in education. And what I mean by that is culturally adaptive instructional practices, right? Dr. Cabrera, if you can, and this is kind of a subset of a question to this question, is can you define in maybe about 30 seconds the difference between culturally responsive practices and culturally adaptive instructional practices? Is there a little variance between the definitions? Is responsive different, radically different from being adaptive, but they address the whole culture piece, which is great for the totality?
Great question. And I'm going to say it's more than just being semantical about it.
Yeah.
Because I think it's part of what the skill set of the teacher is. I mean, they are the person who has to be able to be agile enough to say, all right, and a culturally responsive approach to say, we have intentionally reshaped the curriculum offering that the kids are going to accept, right? Mm-hmm. To make cultural connections. Mm-hmm. I'm good with that too. And if we did that all the time, I think it'd be a different world. But I think a culturally adaptive person would say, all right, I have an understanding of that. And I know there's a balance here that we're working within the system that I want to make connections for Dr. Connor's lived experience or Dr. Carrero's lived experience. And I have to be able to play that in a manner that is instructionally, you know, artistic, if you will. You know, so there's a skill set involved there. So, you know, we want to move from saying there's only one way to approach instruction. We're not going to, you know, abandon that to say there's now only another way to instruction. It's sort of like you need to find a balanced set. There's some structures that do make sense still, I believe, for kids' success, because there's a bit of a discipline to learning, you know. So we don't want to say it's just organics. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, make it efficient. I'm not sure that's a great answer, but in my head,
no, that's perfect. No, Dr. Carrera, that's perfect, because again, we want to be able to provide the ideologies to our viewers and to the audience today, and then that they can go back and do their own investigation and exploration of how to be able to extend, take a look at, compare some points, even as you stated before in your previous answer, building systems level capacity around culturally adaptive instructional practices. But I think one thing that's very clear that you stated was explicit expectations, right? Clarity of expectations. So if leaders are clear about and also realize the vision regarding culturally adaptive instructional practices, going back to your answer, Dr. Cabrera, that you stated as a fundamental answer within systems design, is we have to limit the fragmentation and increase the level of alignment and coherence that addresses our students, who our students are in the lived experiences. Great, great, yes. Dr. Cabrera. Now, I want you to put your superintendent hat back on, the shoulders that we all stand on, Dr. Cabrera, but put your superintendent hat back on, because, you know, and you're probably hearing this across the country around funding with ESSER has concluded. And right now, you know, there's that national tension with how are leaders going to sustain innovative and equity-driven systems to further metabolize excellence for all. Now, with your superintendent hat on, Dr. Cabrera, learning organizations, superintendents, and communities are becoming creative with the reduction of these resources. And we can consider this these reductions draconian in context, because we're seeing that battle between, you know, municipal city structures versus Board of Ed around what's the appropriate funding. We're seeing 8, 9, 10, 12% requests from superintendents. But Dr. Cabrera, what suggestions or advocacy recommendations do you have for Board of Education members, leaders, and communities regarding sustainability during current and future budget constraints?
Wow, that's a really great question. And you're right, we are wrestling. I work with enough leaders as we are trying to determine, you know, how to move forward. And here's the dilemma at hand. We may have propped up a few things using ESSER money. And actually, to some extent, ESSER money was, I mean, it was wonderful having it available, but it also, some ways, accentuated the fragmentation, because we start throwing in new programs, bringing new bodies out, this and that, and this type of thing. And so we are reluctant to let go of it. Mm. So one approach would be, so how do I minimize across the board so I can sort of hang on to everything, maybe to, at lesser scale? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a proponent of that, but I know people who do that, because let's face it, as a superintendent, it's also a political position. Mm-hmm. And you may have brought on some programs and hired a few people that was politically expedient, someone's pet project, another good idea. I mean, I think most people want to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. I think that all superintendents at this level have to be surgical in their analysis and using the funds in a very tactical way. So the guiding question is, what are you willing to abandon in order to leverage stronger mm-hmm. strategies that will take you to your outcome, your desired outcome? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, my first superintendency, it was in a large district, like 16,000 kids. I thought, good scale. I really visited every school mm-hmm. in my first 100 days. I said, so what is it we should give up? You know, what's working? What should we give up? Here's my discovery. Everyone had an idea of what they should give up, but there's always someone else who wanted to keep it. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, no one give up anything.
Right.
For some people, it felt good, right? So this is where, you know, you almost have to say, the courage is to say, all right, you know, it's a choice between A, B, and C. I'm giving up A because C and D, B and C will make a better difference. Not that A was a bad thing. Yeah. But this is why I'm going to invest my funds.
Yeah.
And that takes some courage, and it takes some political will.
Yeah.
Now, particularly if you say, you know, doing strategies B and C not only provides good value to the whole system, but it targets those kids who are less successful. Yeah. That's equity in the capital, you know, in capital words. That is not always a politically, you know, acceptable approach.
Yeah.
So equity leaders have to be strong and clear about their argument. But I think that's really the guiding question. What are you willing to abandon? And you have to be strong enough to, and clever enough to say, I've done the study. I've had my team do this. These are our best strategies. Now it comes back to the coherence approach.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remove the fragmentation.
Dr. Cabrera, thank you for that, because when I think about it, right, and where the ESSER funds has concluded, we see in great tension between cities and Board of Education to keep some of these programs alive, to keep some of these additional resources. I really love your response, Dr. Cabrera, when you have to surgically, analytically, and from a diagnostic lens, evaluate all programs and the programs that are not generating the best academic or systems return on investment, we have to be able to abandon. But I love what you stated. The abandonment is investing in those other programs, but it takes the courage and the political will to be able to do that. Dr. Cabrera, that is a textbook answer, because when we evaluate these specific programs with this surgical and analytical lens, that's when we start unpacking some of the gap areas, or are we accelerating growth, whether it be in our historically excluded group, marginalized students groups as well. We have to be able to look at the balance. And sometimes, as you stated, some of these projects were individual projects that were led by individuals who really loved it or love it, but we know that it's not generating the best academic return on investment from the context of a systems level approach. Very, very good, right? If we really want to metabolize excellence, we have to invest in the programs that are impacting and influencing our students today. But Dr. Cabrera, you made it. Last question.
I'm going to try,
Dr. Cabrera. I don't know if I'm going to be very successful with this, but I'm going to try to limit you to three words. Three words for this. And Dr. Cabrera, if you need to expand, go right ahead. But what three words, the lasting three words that you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regarding leadership, culturally adaptive systems, and excellence for learning organizations in the AC stage of education, meaning after COVID-19.
Well, okay, this is a tough task, as you know, Dr. Connor, because as superintendents, we're not typically people of a few words. but I'm going to take a stab, and I'm going to say it this way. My first word is expect hope.
Mm-hmm.
Expect hope in a different, and I'll explain that in just a minute. My second word is courage, leadership mm-hmm. courage. Mm-hmm. And my third word is relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Expect hope. This is not about I'm guessing, I'm throwing darts and just wishing. Expect hope is saying there's a readiness and I'm waiting for the right opportunity to come here so I can apply my skills, my persistence, and my focus to try new things. That's expecting hope. Courage is really about moving beyond what the system typically provides us and really disrupt it. I like your term. Mm-hmm. The courage to disrupt. Because even getting the system that is doing what it's doing better just perpetuates mediocrity.
Yeah.
And the last one, relationships. We are a people business. So as a systems leader, to the extent possible, you need to know your people. You need to know their strengths. And you need to know their needs, because that's how you build their capacity. The strengths is how you utilize their talents to advance your work. And, you know, frankly, you want knowing your people builds a level of trust that every effective organization has. So those are how I would approach it.
Hope, courage, and relationships. But I want to add on for my viewers, which you said, expect hope. Leadership, courage, and then, of course, relationships. Dr. Cabrera, this has been an absolute honor to have you, a legend, on Voices for Excellence. If my audience want to find out more about the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy or executive coaching that you're doing or the work that you're doing across the country, how would they be able to contact you?
All right. Well, you could contact the Colorado ALAS website, and it has information about the Four Corners and certainly has my email address. If you want to learn a little bit about executive coaching and the like, so my consultant is called the RONS Group, Robust Outcomes, Novel Solutions. Kind of clever, I guess.
It is.
And my email address is just simple, ron.g.cabrera@gmail.com. And I would just ask them if they want to reach out to me. I'm happy to respond. I respond to all of them. Say, you know, I heard you in Dr. Connor's podcast, and I want to have a conversation. That makes me hopeful.
Thank you, Dr. Cabrera. As I stated, this has been an absolute honor. I look forward to visiting you, seeing you in person. With the Four Corners Latinx Leadership Academy. That right there, Dr. Cabrera, I could tell you this. I wish I was coming up through the ranks, because with you and your leadership, and I know the session and cohort focuses and the intentionality around the mentorship, right? The mentorship that you provide each of those cohort members, they're lucky to have you and your team. So
No,
thank you
thank
for
you.
all that you do within the ecosystem, Dr. Cabrera.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Good luck to your work as well.
Thank you, Dr. Cabrera. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.